Chapter 18. The 2008 Problem. In July 2007, Putin flew to tiny Guatemala on a personal mission that would assuage an international slight that dated to 1980, when the Soviet Union hosted the Summer Olympics in Moscow and much of the West boycotted to protest the invasion of Afghanistan. Bringing the games back to Russia became an obsessive quest that Putin had pursued from the time Sobchak made an improbable bid for Petersburg in the 1990s. As an avid sportsman and fitness obsessive, a judoka, a skier, and a swimmer, Putin loved the Olympics. As a leader, he saw hosting them as the means to affirm Russia's return to its rightful place on the world stage. In 2001, not long after he assumed the presidency, he went on a skiing trip to St. Anton am Arlberg in Austria, accompanied by an oligarch of the Yeltsin era, Vladimir Potanin, and Boris Nemtsov, the liberal who had initially thrown his support behind Putin. Seeing the resorts nestled in the alpine scenery, Putin lamented that the new Russia had none. "I want to get one European-style winter resort," he told his companions. The oligarchs, beholden to Putin, old and new, obliged. In January 2006, Yuri Kovalchuk's Bank Russia opened a ski resort called Igora, 52 miles north of Petersburg, on the highway to the Azara Dacha Kovalchuk shared with Putin, with 7 trails, though a vertical drop of less than 400 feet. Potanin, whose holding company, Interos, controlled the metal giant Norilsk Nickel, and kept him at the top of the list of Russian billionaires, drafted blueprints for a far more ambitious project on a ridge called Rosa Kutor, in the mountains above the Black Sea resort of Sochi. Putin, who regularly vacationed at Sochi's presidential retreat, visited the remote site above the forlorn mountain village of Krasnaya Polyana, and thus a legend was born. He came to see this road, Anatoly Pakhomov, who would later become Sochi's mayor, said, referring to the precarious, potholed route that wended beside the Muzimta River. And Putin said, "This beauty, these riches in Krasnaya Polyana should belong to all the people." For Putin, the projects were not investments in the purest business sense. In fact, they were economically dubious. Rather, they were patriotic endeavors carried out for the greater public good, which he believed he best understood and which he alone decided. Soon Gazprom, firmly under Putin's control, began a similar resort in an adjacent valley near Rosa Kutor. The two projects were the foundation for the new bid Putin was flying to Guatemala to present to the delegates of the International Olympic Committee. Sochi's bid was submitted by Russia's Olympic Committee in 2005. But despite Bakhomov's hagiographic recollection, the idea of staging the games there did not originate with Putin. He was carrying on an ambition that the country's leaders had harbored for decades. In the wake of the Moscow Olympics, the geriatric Politburo in the Kremlin secretly debated a bid for the Winter Olympics, reviewing 4 possible locations across the Soviet Union. The dream had to be abandoned as the leadership was overtaken by the rapid succession of general secretaries in the 1980s, and finally by the promise and upheaval of perestroika. 3 of the cities they had reviewed, Almaty in Kazakhstan, Bakuryani in Georgia, and Sakhakadzor in Armenia, were no longer part of Russia at all. Only Sochi still was. While it had been a favored seaside resort since Stalin's days, it lacked any of the modern facilities required for the Olympics, beginning with a lack of functioning ski slopes. In 1995, during Yeltsin's erratic presidency, the Russians had submitted a bid for Sochi for the 2002 Winter Olympics, but it failed even to make the shortlist. Putin tried again in 2005, bidding for the Summer Olympics. Moscow went up against New York, Madrid, Paris, and London for the 2012 Summer Games, and finished last in the final balloting. The International Olympic Committee's evaluations pointedly questioned whether Russia had the capacity to organize the Games in its own capital. How could Russia, 2 years later, possibly make the case that Sochi, a decaying resort without a single Olympic standard facility, would be ready for the Winter Olympics of 2014? Sochi was competing against Salzburg in Austria and Pyeongchang, South Korea, the favorite going into the final vote, having narrowly lost the previous bid. Few gave Sochi much chance. The 119th session of the International Olympic Committee took place in the Westin Camino Real in the heart of Guatemala City. Putin had prepared intensely, rehearsing his speech in stilted, heavily accented, but nearly perfect English. Among the officials presenting the final bids, he spoke first in the morning. "The Olympic cluster in Sochi will be the first world-class mountain sports center in the new Russia," he began, making it clear he had absorbed the Politburo's review from the 1980s and the consequences of the Soviet dissolution. "Let me point out that after the breakup of the Soviet Union, Russia has lost all of its sports venues in the mountains. Would you believe it?" He sounded incredulous, even offended by the cruel historical turn. He highlighted the novelty of Sochi's location on the Black Sea, abutting the peaks of the Caucasus. "On the seashore, you can enjoy a fine spring day, but up in the mountains, it's winter." He pledged to spend $12 billion to erect the venues, a staggering sum that exceeded what Vancouver planned to spend in 2010. He promised a safe, enjoyable, and memorable experience, and even joked that he would ease the city's chronic traffic jams. He finished with a flourish of stilted French, thanking the committee for its consideration. And then he left the hotel. He had staked so much of his prestige, and Russia's, on the vote, but he refused to stay for it, as if he anticipated an unhappy outcome and feared the embarrassment of having to witness the delegations of Salzburg or Pyeongchang celebrating. Instead, he boarded his presidential jet and began the long flight back to Moscow. By now, Putin was vilified in much of the West. And yet his remonstrations to the bullying Americans, and the fact that he was not wrong about the bloodshed in Iraq, won him grudging admiration in some quarters, and there were those who thought that played a role in the voting, which began while Putin was over the Atlantic. Sochi came in second in the first round of votes, receiving 34 votes, compared to 36 for Pyeongchang. Salzburg won only 25 and was eliminated. When the second round finished, though, Sochi drew more of Salzburg's votes, edging Pyeongchang by 4 votes. Russia had won. Putin had won. "He was nice," Jean-Claude Killy, the French ski champion and a member of the International Olympic Committee, explained after the vote. "He spoke French. He never speaks French. He spoke English. He never speaks English. The Putin charisma can explain 4 votes." The deputy prime minister who remained in Guatemala, Alexander Zhukov, telephoned Putin on the presidential plane to inform him of the committee's choice. Putin, in turn, called the chairman of the International Olympic Committee, Jacques Rogge, and thanked him for what he called an impartial decision. At home, Putin's popularity soared even higher. When he returned triumphantly to Moscow, he stepped out of his jet and met assembled reporters at the VIP hall of Vnukovo Airport. "It is, beyond any doubt, a judgment of our country," he declared. Only in a country desperate for affirmation could the choice of an Olympics have loomed so disproportionately large. "Russia has risen from its knees," German Greff declared in Guatemala City. And yet, through the summer and fall, those inside the Kremlin's walls were consumed by a fear that without Putin, Russia might fall back down. Uncertainty gripped the political and business elite because, at the height of his political powers, the end of his presidency suddenly loomed. Putin's repeated assertions that he would not amend the Constitution so he could serve a third term had finally sunk in. The elite had come to the unhappy realization that these were not simply coy deflections. Putin had created his own problem. He wanted to adhere to the strict letter of the law and assure a smooth transition to a new president. but he was determined that it be one that he alone controlled. His strategy was unquestionably authoritarian, but he sought the patina of legitimacy, fearing that a reprise of a color revolution, fomented by his enemies abroad, would destroy the system he had spent nearly 8 years building. Sergei Ivanov still seemed the presumptive frontrunner in the undeclared campaign to replace Putin, trailed closely by Dmitry Medvedev, though periodically Putin would drop teasing hints that others might be considered. Perhaps his old friend Vladimir Yakunin of the Russian Railways, or even, for diversity's sake, the governor of Petersburg, Valentina Matvienko. None dared declare an ambition for the post, which would usurp Putin's prerogative. Ivanov had quietly assembled an advisory council to prepare policy positions, though, while Medvedev's work on the national projects assured him a conspicuous public role. Both gathered informal supporters and opponents in the deliberations that swirled through the government. But by the end of summer, Putin had not yet signaled a choice. He was in no hurry. A designated heir might steal attention from him, rendering him a lame duck, which seemed not only inconceivable, but also unacceptable. As a result of his irresolution, the ranks of the bureaucracy became paralyzed, unwilling to make decisions that would last beyond the end of Putin's presidency, or affect their place in whatever administration was to come. His irresolution also created dangerous tensions that spilled indecorously into the public. Putin stoked the speculation further when, on September 12th, he revealed the latest act in the theater of managed democracy. Mikhail Fradkov, the loyal, functional prime minister since 2004, walked into Putin's office in the Kremlin and, cameras rolling, unexpectedly resigned. "I understand the political processes taking place at the moment, and I would like to see you have as free a hand as possible in making decisions," Fradkov said. He did not sound like a man stepping down on selfless principle as much as an actor who had not rehearsed his lines enough. He looked forlorn and troubled. Putin at least made the effort to seem thoughtful and considerate. "Perhaps you are right," he replied, thanking him for his service, though he went on to point out that some mistakes had been made. He said it was important to reflect on how the new nominee would affect the political situation before the parliamentary elections in December and the presidential election in March. A few hours later, he announced an even more unexpected choice to replace Fradkov, Viktor Zubkov. No one outside the Kremlin and few inside it understood Putin's decision. Even Sergei Ivanov did not know it was coming. If Putin was following Yeltsin's model of designating his successor, tapping a new prime minister on the eve of the presidential campaign, he had opted for a man who by design had kept a low profile. Zubkov, born in the early months of the Great Patriotic War, was part of the cadre of men whose bonds with Putin had been forged in Petersburg in the 1990s. After the early barter for food deals created a scandal in the winter of 1991, Zubkov, a former collective farm boss, had assisted Putin by using his influence among regional farmers to resume supplies of produce to the hungry city. He became one of Putin's most trusted associates, taking over the city's taxation enforcement, and later joining him and Igor Sechin in producing dissertations at the Mining Institute in the 1990s. He followed Putin to Moscow, where for 7 years he had quietly headed the new Russian Financial Monitoring Agency, a department that gave him and Putin exclusive knowledge about the flow of money in and out of the country's businesses, information that was invaluable in enforcing loyalty and thus maintaining some sort of equilibrium among the rival financial empires being established, many of which had connections to the state itself. "Not once, I would like to emphasize, did Viktor Zubkov abuse this trust," Putin later explained. After his announcement, Putin then flew off to the regions of Chuvashia and Belgorod to see how Medvedev's national projects were reviving the nation's agriculture, leaving the political elite to ponder the meaning of his unforeseen gambit. Had Putin decided against Medvedev or Ivanov after all? He certainly wanted to signal that the decision was still an open one. On September 14th, he said there were at least five serious candidates for the presidency, but he would not reveal them. Zubkov's nomination, swiftly rubber-stamped by the Duma 2 days later, did little to calm the behind-the-scenes power struggle that had been unfolding all through Putin's year of uncertainty. This struggle, which had become known as the War of the Clans, erupted unexpectedly on October 2nd, when a special detachment of the FSB ostentatiously arrested a senior official of the country's anti-narcotics agency, Lieutenant General Alexander Bulbov, as he arrived at Domodedovo Airport. Because Bulbov traveled with his own security detail, the arrest very nearly erupted into a shootout in the terminal. Bulbov, a decorated veteran of the Soviet war in Afghanistan, was a senior deputy to Viktor Cherkasov, one of the KGB men Putin had known since the 1970s. On Putin's orders, Bulbov had been assigned to the long-stalled investigation of smuggling at the furniture store Trikita, as well as at a second one called Grand. The case had begun in 2000, when customs officials confiscated a shipment of furniture from China and discovered that the owners of Trikita had evaded duties and taxes with the complicity of senior officials in the FSB. Vladimir Ustinov, as prosecutor general, had suspended the investigation, but the controversy lingered, seemingly leaving a trail of victims, including Yuri Shikuchikin, the parliamentary deputy who had written about the case for Novaya Gazeta. After dismissing Ustinov, Putin had ordered a more vigorous prosecution, but now the man heading it was under arrest by the FSB, accused of authorizing a series of wiretaps of businessmen, journalists, and, it seemed, Cherkasov's rivals inside Putin's court, the Siloviki allied with Igor Sechin. From the beginning, Putin's courtiers had pursued shifting alliances and ambitions, but Putin had enforced at least the public appearance of unity. Now, with the end of the presidential term in sight, the tensions threatened to become open conflict. The foundation of Putin's power, the men he had installed throughout the ranks of government, no longer seemed as solid as it had. The arrest of a deputy and four other officers from his agency compelled Cherkasov to speak out, perhaps because he could no longer reach the president, access to whom was controlled by a rival allied with Sechin. A devoted, even romantic operative who was unapologetic about his KGB past, Cherkasov wrote an extraordinary open letter that appeared on the front page of Kommersant, detailing what had until then been the subject of only speculation and rumor about the inner workings of Putin's Kremlin. He wrote that a war had broken out in the ranks of the special services that had been the salvation of the nation, but that now cynically pursued commerce and profit. He all but accused the FSB of arresting his deputy to cover up its complicity in the Trikita schemes. "Do not try to be a merchant and a warrior at the same time," he wrote, seeming to address all the former and current intelligence officers in Putin's court. "It cannot happen. It's either or." "The struggle within Putin's ranks could not be won," he went on. "It was a war that would end in the complete dissolution of what Putin had built." Curiously, though, he did not call it the state. He called it the corporation. The internecine fighting continued through the fall, and neither Putin nor Zubkov seemed able to control it. In November, the long-forgotten, or possibly suppressed, report on Putin's malfeasance in the export scandal in Petersburg 16 years before resurfaced. The Clan War now seemed aimed at discrediting Putin, who soon faced the first public accusations that he had amassed a fortune himself by using as fronts his closest friends from Petersburg, Yuri Kovalchuk and Gennady Timchenko. Rumors of a coup d'etat rumbled through Moscow, just as they had in the last summer of Yeltsin's presidency, though in this case it was never clear whether the intent was to overthrow Putin or overthrow the Constitution and keep him in office. An appeal for calm appeared in the nationalist newspaper Zavtra in the form of a letter by five former directors or regional directors of the Soviet KGB, including Vladimir Khrushchev, the man who had led the abortive putsch in 1991. Trust our experience, they wrote. A great disaster could happen. Putin said little about the struggle, seeking to maintain an equilibrium between the competing factions, though some suspected him of orchestrating it to preserve his ultimate authority as arbiter. He chastised Cherkasov for airing these kinds of problems, but went on to expand the authority of the drug enforcement agency Cherkasov oversaw. He also kept his ultimate plans for the succession to himself, waiting for the outcome of the parliamentary elections in early December. Russia's elections by now had become desultory affairs, so thoroughly controlled by the central authorities that they lacked genuine competition, and therefore suspense. The party of power, United Russia, had all the advantages of the Kremlin's resources, leaving the tolerated opposition, the communists, the nationalist liberal democrats, and a new party headed by one of Putin's political allies from Petersburg, Just Russia, little oxygen to breathe. Putin's liberal and democratic critics, led now by Putin's former prime minister, Mikhail Kazyanov, and the former world chess champion, Garry Kasparov, mounted determined but quixotic protests, but they and other potential candidates were simply disqualified from the ballot on bureaucratic pretexts. One who did not face administration hurdles was Andrei Lugovoy, who, basking in the limelight of his notoriety as a murder suspect, joined the candidate slate of the Liberal Democrats, assuring himself a seat in the Duma, and thus immunity from prosecution, which hardly seemed necessary given Russia's refusal to extradite him. To Putin, the unruly leaders of the opposition represented a conspiracy against Russia itself. Kasparov, who had retired from chess in 2005 to devote himself to loosening Putin's grip on power, proved to be a perfect foil. He was arrested for organizing protest rallies in Moscow, Petersburg, and other cities the weekend before the parliamentary vote, and sentenced to 5 days in detention. When Kasparov, a polyglot, shouted something in English as he was manhandled into a police bus, Putin, who had once admired the young champion's brash victory in 1985, responded dismissively, "Why did Mr. Kasparov, when arrested, speak out in English rather than Russian?" he asked Time magazine, which, despite his vilification in and of the West, had just named him Person of the Year. Just think about it. The whole thrust of this thing was directed toward other countries rather than the Russian people, and when a politician works the crowd of other nations rather than the Russian nation, it tells you something. If you aspire to be a leader of your own country, you must speak your own language, for God's sake. Putin still had not joined the party of power, United Russia, but heading into the parliamentary election, he sat at the top of its candidates list, clearing the way for him to remain the party's leader, should he choose to be. Some believed he would step down from the presidency, but use the party leadership to remain the ultimate political authority. He campaigned for the party no more than he had in his own elections, but merely presided over the state, portrayed on the nightly news as Russia's savior. On the eve of the election, he delivered a nationally televised speech that sounded very much like a valedictory address. "We have done a lot of work together," he said in his firm, clipped style. "The economy is growing steadily. Poverty is in retreat, albeit slowly. We are going to step up the fight against crime and corruption." He made the rare acknowledgement that not everything had gone well, but moved on to the rationale of his presidency. "Let's remember what we started with 8 years ago, the kind of pit we had to drag the country out of." Russia had a long way to go, yes, but it could not succumb to those who have already tried unsuccessfully to govern the country. The phrasing was discordant. Whom did he mean? Yeltsin, who had lifted him to the Kremlin? The communists of the Soviet era? The communist platform called for greater social justice for pensioners, but not, significantly, a radical break from the economic boom over which Putin had presided. Putin's enemy was the mysterious other, the frenzied barbarians at the gates about to storm the walls with the sole intent of destroying Russia. Today, such people would like to rehash the plans for Russia's development, to change the course that the Russian people support, and return to times of humiliation, dependence, and dissolution. When the votes were cast on December 2nd, United Russia officially won 64% of the vote, though few believed the validity of the tally or, as before, the suspiciously high turnout in some regions. And yet, no one poured into the streets as they had in Ukraine to demand a recount or a revote. By now, as Kasparov had warned in his campaign, it was impossible to challenge the legal mechanisms that ensured a preordained victory. The other parties, led by the communists, trailed badly, though the Liberal Democrats did well enough that Andrei Lugovoy won a seat. The day after the vote, Putin declared that the outcome signified the maturity of the country's democracy. With the presidential election now only months away, Putin's future remained unclear, even to those closest to him. He faced the defining choice of his political career, his greatest legacy after the conquest of Chechnya, the economic boom, the winning of the bid for an Olympic Games, would be a transition of power. In Russia's long history, only an enfeebled Boris Yeltsin had stepped down voluntarily, and now Putin stood at the same crossroads. With an obsequious constitutional majority, he could easily, even at that late hour, ram through a revision of the constitution and remain in office. There would have been few protests in Russia, where his popularity remained astonishingly high, and the rebuke that would surely come from the international community would only affirm his case that the country's enemies refused to accept its destiny as a restored power. Or he could hand power to a new leader and retire. The unexpected mission he had been given by Yeltsin 8 years before, take care of Russia, having arguably been accomplished far beyond anyone's expectation at the time. It was 8 days after the parliamentary vote, and barely 3 months before the presidential election, when Putin at last made his choice clear with one final bit of political theater before the prolonged winter holidays. On December 10th, the leader of United Russia, Boris Gritslov, joined the leaders of three other parties in Putin's Kremlin office. They had deliberated over the possible candidates for the nation's highest office, Gritslov told Putin, and wanted to discuss with him in detail their recommendation. The meeting played as if it were a consultation, not a decision of Putin's that had already been made. It was politics as performance art, with not very good actors. Gritslov explained to Putin that he and the other party leaders were unanimous in their choice. Not Ivanov or Zubkov or any of the other unnamed candidates who had been touted by Putin himself, but rather the one whose star had seemed to wane over the last year, Dmitry Medvedev, the diminutive protege who had worked loyally at Putin's side now for 17 years. Medvedev just happened to be in attendance as the television cameras suddenly panned back to reveal Putin, turned to him in feigned ignorance. Dmitry Anatolievich, have you been consulted on this? Yes, he replied, playing his role as dutifully as the others. There were preliminary consultations, and they were positive. We will continue these discussions today and tomorrow. Putin then complained that there were a lot of political events crammed into a rather short period of time before the new year. But life has to continue, and the law requires that we begin the presidential campaign. He sounded put out, as if the election were a chore that had to be tended to. Instead of explicitly announcing his heir as Yeltsin had, Putin wanted to create the impression that his own choice had been made for him, with the consent of a broad spectrum of Russian society represented by the party leaders in the room. Putin, with the reins of power in his hands, wanted to preserve the pretense of a pluralistic choice, a managed democracy, not an authoritarian writ. For all his bluster and dark ridicule of the West, he still sought its validation, something a constitutional grab for power would have precluded. Putin, legalistically minded, sought a way to ensure his succession within the strict letter of the law, if not the spirit. Among the Kremlin's clans, Medvedev seemed the least divisive choice, acceptable to the various factions arrayed beneath Putin, with the exception perhaps of Sergei Ivanov and Igor Sechin. He was not viewed as a serious threat to any of them, least of all to Putin himself. Medvedev had his allies in government, the other liberals and reformers, but he had no power base of his own. Putin, at the end of his presidency, had orchestrated a barely plausible transfer of power in a resurgent superpower, but even then did not unveil his own fate. The final act in his political theater came a day later. Medvedev, addressing the nation as the presumptive president-in-waiting, declared that for the sake of stability, he would, if elected, nominate as his prime minister Vladimir Putin. The arrangement would come to be known as the tandem, and it reassured those who had been most worried about Putin's departure from the Kremlin. After 8 years at the helm of state, Putin would not really be leaving after all. On April 11, 2008, a few weeks before Dmitry Medvedev's inauguration as president, a relatively new tabloid newspaper, Moskovsky Correspondent, printed a short article that dared to test the limits of the political era that many hoped the new president would usher in. The article, by a veteran reporter named Sergei Topol, was only 641 words long, and its tone was neither particularly salacious nor slanderous. Rather, it was sympathetic when it came to the delicate matter of Putin's private life. It was not entirely true, but it lifted the veil of secrecy that had enveloped Putin's family for 8 years. The Sarkozy syndrome, the headline declared, referring to the French president's recent divorce and his marriage to his third wife, the model and pop singer Carla Bruni. Putin's personal life, Topol wrote, was the inverse. He had remained married through his first 2 terms as president, but now that he was stepping down from the highest post, there is little that binds the first couple. The demobilization, as Topol put it, freed him now to find time to resolve his personal matters. And then, 4 paragraphs into the article, came the supposed bombshell. The Putins had secretly divorced in February, and according to our informer, he planned in June to remarry. The bride would be Alina Kabayeva, a world champion rhythmic gymnast, winner of the bronze medal in the Sydney Olympics in 2000, and a gold medal in Athens 4 years later. Kabayeva, then not quite 25, was one of the most glamorous celebrities in Russia. By 2001, with her sporting career taking off, she had become the public face of the political party that would become United Russia. In the elections in December 2007, she even stood as a candidate on the party's slate, recruited as part of an effort to make the party more attractive, and duly assigned a seat in the Duma when it swept the vote. Despite having lived in the public eye for 8 years, Putin had shielded details of his private life from virtually any scrutiny or public discussion. His daughters, especially, disappeared into a sheltered world of pervasive security, shaped by their father's fears and paranoia. "I have taken my wife and children away and hid them," he once told his old friend Sergei Roldugin, Masha's godfather. In the beginning, at a time when the war in Chechnya struck the very heart of Moscow, Putin feared for their security, and few questioned his motives. Unlike the children of other Russians, politicians, and businessmen, Putin's daughters did not use the advantages of birth to propel their careers or celebrity. They simply vanished, accepting the lives of comfortable, if constrained, anonymity. Except for the early interviews they gave, intended to hone his image as a doting, if stern, father, he never again used them in the way politicians elsewhere use their children as props. They finished school in the isolation of tutors behind maximum security. They both learned to play piano and violin, encouraged by Roldugin and Putin's own interest in music. Roldugin believed they could have become professional musicians if they had a different fate. They attended their father's alma mater, but under assumed names, Even their acquaintances were unaware of their relation to the nation's leader. Over time, Putin's relationship with them became more distant, consumed as he was by the duties of power. Together, they once recorded a CD for their father of their music that included Bach's Concerto in B minor. After they moved on to university, Putin would listen at night, silencing anyone who tried to interrupt when he listened. By the time they reached adulthood, no one outside their family circle even knew what they looked like. Lyudmila had never settled comfortably into the public life of a politician's wife. Early in her husband's presidency, she had granted occasional interviews and accompanied him on his state visits, appearing beside the first ladies of the United States and Britain, among others, but only as protocol dictated, but later on, less and less. She curated an organization called the Center for the Development of the Russian Language, devoting herself to the promotion of reading and education and the unifying bonds of the language in the Ruski Mir, or Russian world, including those who, as Putin would often point out, found themselves abandoned beyond Russia's borders when the Soviet Union collapsed. Putin adopted the theme more explicitly after the humiliation of the Orange Revolution in Ukraine and created a government organization, the Russian World Foundation, to champion the rights of the diaspora and keep them, at least culturally, in the motherland's embrace. Lyudmila's influence on her husband's policies, though, was inconsequential, even in private. She never meddled in Putin's politics, Roldugin said, and Putin never asked her to. They were rarely seen being affectionate or even cordial in public. Their appearances together bordered on the uncomfortable and had become less and less frequent by Putin's second term. Privately, they lived together, dined together with their daughters when they were still at home, and rarely quarreled openly, according to Roldugin, but they ceased to be intimate. The Kremlin's grip on the media, of course, ensured that even the most benign scrutiny of his private life was taboo. He was no different in that than most previous Russian and Soviet leaders, who were traditionally portrayed as preeminent and thus remote figures. He was the father of the nation, as much as father of his own family, an image the Kremlin relentlessly crafted. A film that appeared in February was seen as a new effort to portray Putin as a dedicated husband at a time when the rumors to the contrary were becoming more persistent. Its title, A Kiss Off the Record, came from a scene in which an influential politician very much resembling Putin kisses a woman very much resembling Lyudmila before a phalanx of photographers and playfully admonishes the journalist not to publicize the encounter. The producer-director, Olga Zhulina, insisted the film was fictional, but the details came straight from Putin's life. His KGB service in Dresden, Lyudmila's car accident, his unexpected rise to power. The film's hero even went by Platov, Putin's code name from his days in the KGB Academy, a knowing allusion to the ultimate inspiration for the project. It departed from Putin's life only in depicting Lyudmila's role. In the dramatic climax, she fills in for Platov when he is late to an important press conference abroad, showing such poise and intelligence that she earns a standing ovation from the press. One interpretation of the film, that it was intended to feed the fantasies of Putin's female admirers, suggested that its underlying message was that the political fate of the country rested on the stability of the Platovs' marriage. The real reporters in the Kremlin pool knew not to ask, let alone write, about Putin's family. By the end of his presidency, though, it was impossible not to notice what Topol called the widely discussed rumors that all was not well with the second half of the first couple. The fact that Vladimir Putin, as well as any healthy man, is not indifferent to beautiful, sporty women is well known in his inner circle, Topol wrote, and then went on to mention the gossip that linked him with other women, including a well-known anchor of the state television news on Channel 1, Yekaterina Andreeva, a former basketball star. He even alluded to the journalist Yelena Trigubova and her story of Putin's taking her to an emptied restaurant for sushi. The article referred to the personal relationships and scandals of other world leaders, from Sarkozy to Bill Clinton to Václav Klaus of the Czech Republic, and suggested that perhaps the Russian public, too, was prepared to accept a leader's divorce as the normal state of affairs, rather than the mythology that the Kremlin had created of the contented domicile. As speciously sourced as the article was, Kabayeva's spokeswoman denied it, and the marriage in June did not, in fact, take place. The article created a sensation, titillating the foreign press and terrifying the Russian journalists who knew it had gone further than any had dared before. The article spread on the internet, which was then still outside the control of the Kremlin's minders, testing the once ironclad shield erected around Putin's personal life. Dmitry Medvedev's presidential election campaign had promised a more open Russia, a freer place, and perhaps now it was possible to speak of issues that had long been forbidden. After a week of churning rumors, it became impossible for Putin to avoid the matter any longer. He had to address the matter during a press conference in Italy with Silvio Berlusconi, whose own personal proclivities provided endless material for the freewheeling Italian press. Berlusconi, who had just won the latest round of elections, had a deep admiration for Putin and his political style, and the feeling was mutual. Putin took to wearing suits made by Berlusconi's tailor, and they became close in business and in private, negotiating deals and exchanging visits and lavish gifts, including a four-poster bed with curtains that would become fodder in Berlusconi's much-publicized tryst with an aggrieved prostitute, Patrizia Daddario. The Italian leader called it Putin's bed. The question came from a Russian reporter, Natalia Melikova, of Nezavisimaya Gazeta. She was careful to note that the rumors had reached the Italian press, but she appeared trepidatious anyway. She began with a question about the purpose of the visit, but tacked on one about the rumored divorce and whether the Putin's eldest, Masha, had in fact moved to Germany and married. After a short aside, Putin emphasized that he did not intend to duck the more incendiary question. "The first thing I want to say is this. There is not a word of truth in what you said," he replied. It was clear he was familiar with the article, because he went on to mention Andreeva too, and rumors of other relationships, even though the reporter had not. He then tried to make light of it. "I think that nobody will be surprised if I say that I like them all, just as I like all Russian women. I think that no one will be offended if I say that I personally believe that our Russian women are the most talented and the most beautiful. The only women who can compare with them in this regard are Italian women." After the translation, the Italians chuckled in approval as Berlusconi beamed and nodded. Then Putin turned icy. "I am, of course, aware of the cliché that politicians live in glass houses, and people, of course, have a right to know how those who are involved in public activities actually live, but even in this case, there have to be some limits." He went on, "There is such a thing as one's private life, with which nobody should be allowed to interfere. I have always reacted negatively to those who, with their snotty noses and erotic fantasies, meddle in other people's lives." Then he changed the subject, citing the growth of the economy under his presidency. Russia had reduced the number of those who lived in poverty twofold. Real incomes were growing, and at least no one is asking about Chechnya anymore. The answer proved revealing. His public accomplishments were what mattered, not his personal life. Berlusconi shook his head as Putin spoke. He, above all, could empathize. As his friend finished, he put his two hands together to mime the firing of a machine gun, pointing directly at the young journalist who had asked the question. On the same day, back in Moscow, the owner of the newspaper announced that he was closing it. He cited its low circulation, but no one believed that. The depth of Putin's relationship with Kabayeva or any other woman would remain unknown to any but his closest friends. And yet there was more than a passing political acquaintance between the two. She had clearly moved into the circle of friends from Petersburg who had emerged during Putin's second term. Only a month before her name surfaced in connection with Putin's, she had joined the advisory council of the newly formed National Media Group, a holding company controlled by Yuri Kovalchuk, whose banking empire had expanded to include some of the country's most prominent television stations and newspapers. Sergei Fursenko, the brother of Putin's Minister of Education, Andrei, and like him, a founding member of the Azara Dacha Cooperative, took over as the director of the company, which would continue to expand its media holdings, forming an ever more potent instrument of the propaganda that girded Putin's power. Kabayeva's inclusion signaled an intimacy with the clique, if not with Putin personally, that had quietly enriched itself during his presidency. Only at the end of his presidency, as he grappled with the 2008 problem, did the veil of secrecy lift a bit. The rumors of their relationship, some thought, might have been a symptom of the struggle underway. In February 2008, on the eve of Medvedev's election, two of Putin's most prominent critics, Boris Nemtsov and Vladimir Milov, had published a 76-page pamphlet that for the first time detailed the business connections that united Putin's circle, including the stunning rise of Yuri Kovalchuk's fortunes. The acquisitions that made up National Media Group, they wrote, included the media assets of Gazprom, purchased in 2005 for $166 million, which Medvedev himself valued 2 years later at $7.5 billion. As former ministers Nemtsov and Milov did not come from the radical fringe of Russia's opposition, but they struggled to have an impact. They hoped the pamphlet would at least encourage a political debate before Medvedev's election. Perhaps Medvedev would even listen to the litany of problems they intended to highlight. Nemtsov, with a doctorate in mathematics, had served as a governor in Nizhny Novgorod and a deputy prime minister under Yeltsin. He had been an early supporter of Putin's, even skiing with him in the Austrian Alps when the Sochi Olympic dream took root. Milov had been a deputy energy minister under Putin. Both had grown disillusioned, however, with the authoritarian trends that followed Putin's early reforms. The pamphlet, Putin, the Results, challenged the very foundation of Putin's valedictory speeches, in which he claimed to have resurrected the country from the ashes of the 1990s, working, as he himself would put it, like a galley slave. The authors acknowledged the stunning rise in GDP and average incomes, the drops in unemployment and poverty, but they argued that Putin's economic miracle was a Potemkin mirage, erected with the profits from rising oil prices and papering over structural problems and a numbing growth in corruption. When Putin took office, Russia ranked 82nd in Transparency International's annual list of the least corrupted countries. By their writing, it had since plummeted to 143rd, putting it in the company of countries like Angola, Guinea-Bissau, and Togo. The disclosure of $90,000 in book advances during Yeltsin's presidency had created a political scandal that led to the dismissal of Anatoly Chubais and other presidential aides, but today's practitioners of corruption laugh at this pathetic sum, they wrote. Today, theft by civil servants is measured in billions and is hidden from the eyes of the people. Large share owners cover for dozens of secret beneficiaries, friends of President Putin, hiding behind their backs. Information on who the real owners are is carefully protected by the secret services, and the subject of corruption in the higher echelons of power is taboo for the Kremlin-controlled media. The pamphlet, like the Moskovsky Correspondent article, sought to break the omerta that permeated the Kremlin in Putin's time, especially when it involved the most secret parts of the president's biography. The authors not only detailed Kovalchuk's rise, but questioned the offloading of Gazprom assets, the profits of Roman Abramovich, the murky business of the gas middleman in Ukraine, Rosukrenergo, and the furtive consolidation of lucrative exports by Gennady Timchenko, founder of Gunvor, the trading company based in Switzerland. With the exception of Abramovich, these new tycoons had remained relatively unknown throughout Putin's 8 years as president. They were barely mentioned in the media, and when they were, it was usually with abundant caveats about the sources of the information. Timchenko's companies now handle the contracts for nearly a third of Russia's oil exports, including most of those of Rosneft since its takeover of Yukos's assets. Timchenko, lean and silver-haired, shared Putin's love of energy markets and politics, as well as judo. But he remained so secretive that suspicion lingered that he had a KGB past, which he would later deny. He carried a Finnish passport as well as a Russian one, and lived in Cologne, Switzerland, in a villa overlooking Lake Geneva. Few photographs even existed of him then, and he granted even fewer interviews. When he finally gave one to the Wall Street Journal 4 months after the pamphlet appeared, he did so on the condition that he would not be photographed, and the location of his company headquarters would not be disclosed. Timchenko denied having more than a passing acquaintance with Putin, insisting, falsely, that they were not friends, and even sued The Economist for suggesting otherwise in an article titled "Grease My Palm." Yet, as their fortunes grew, it became harder for the Putin oligarchy to remain secret. Kovalchuk and Timchenko both debuted on the Forbes list of billionaires the month after the pamphlet appeared. The Rotenberg brothers followed not long after that. Stanislav Belkovsky, the impish, bushy-bearded, bespectacled political strategist who had authored The State and the Oligarchs report on the eve of the assault on Yukos, went even further than Nemtsov and Milov. He claimed that Timchenko acted as a proxy and a partner for Putin, who owned at least part of Gunvor, as well as shares in Gazprom and Surgutneftegaz. He estimated, speculated, really, that Putin's net worth amounted to $40 billion, a figure that was close to a secret estimate by the Central Intelligence Agency a year before, perhaps because its analysts were assessing the same sources as Belkovsky's, or Belkovsky's own claims. Belkovsky insisted his sources were Kremlin insiders, and his previous associations with Igor Sechin and others made this seem plausible, but he also acknowledged he had no documentary evidence. That his critiques of Putin over the years had not endangered him lent some credibility to the claims. Putin responded with humor, and then with seething contempt, when asked about the allegations at his last press conference as president, held the month before Medvedev's election that March. Was it true that Putin was the richest man in Europe? "This is true," he replied. "I am the richest person not only in Europe but in the world. I collect emotions. I am rich in that the people of Russia twice entrusted me with leadership of such a great country as Russia. I believe that this is my greatest wealth." He then dismissed Belkovsky's allegations, which he acknowledged having read as rubbish. They dug it all out of their nose and smeared it on their papers. If the paper trail of Putin's personal wealth was impossible to trace, it was becoming harder for the Kremlin to dismiss the evidence of the interlocking connections among his circle of friends, including Kabayeva. Only weeks after Putin departed the Kremlin, Kabayeva's name appeared on the passenger manifest of a private jet that flew from Switzerland to Prague and then to Sochi, the future site of the Olympics, where Putin would spend more and more of his time as he dispensed the contracts to build the facilities there. Also on the flight was Vladimir Kozhin, who since 2000 had served as the head of the Kremlin Property Administration Office, where Putin first worked when he moved to Moscow, and two businessmen and associates of Putin's, Dmitry Gorelov, an owner of the medical supply company Petromed, and Nikolai Shamalov, who had steered donations to it. What would not be known for 2 more years was that Shamalov and Gorelov were also the principal shareholders of an offshore company called Rosinvest, created on Putin's instructions in 2005. Among its supposed investments was the construction of an enormous villa on the Black Sea coast near Sochi, the one described as fit for a czar. It was surrounded by a wall and security gates adorned with the Russian state emblem. It contained 3 helicopter pads, a service building, a gymnasium, a bungalow, and an amphitheater, in addition to the main house. The private jet that carried them and a crew of 3 Finns from Switzerland to Sochi that day in May belonged to Airfix Aviation, which was then wholly owned by Gennady Timchenko. The surfacing of all these allegations at the end of Putin's presidency created an expectation, a vague hope, really, that the political transition would make change possible. The report by Nemtsov and Milov read like a policy platform for the opposition in a presidential campaign that never really took place. It called for the reforms that Putin had promised but never delivered, a fight against corruption among the police and prosecutors, new laws prohibiting conflicts of interest and business by lawmakers, the professionalization of the army, the construction of modern roads, the creation of a working healthcare system whose absence had contributed to the demographic slump of the population, and a life expectancy for men especially that, while now rising, remained far below the levels of Europe or North America. Putin, they argued, had squandered the rise in energy prices that fueled the undeniable boom, especially in Moscow, which glittered as it never had before. Even with Putin set to remain as prime minister, many wanted to believe that Putin planned eventually to cede political control to a new generation of leaders. With Medvedev at the helm, Putin could become Russia's Deng Xiaoping, officially handing over the reins while wielding power from behind the scenes to ensure the fulfillment of his policies, as Deng did for another 5 years until his death in 1997. Many people close to Putin believed it, and he did not tell them otherwise, even Medvedev, who had spent the previous 8 years at his side in the Kremlin. Medvedev voiced many of the same concerns that these 2 critics had detailed. He believed in modernity, a transition to a freer market and political society, or at least he said so. "Freedom is better than non-freedom," he said, so often it became a slogan of his presidency. It was a banal observation, but after Putin's tenure, it was enough to inspire hope. When the public scandal broke over Putin's relationship with Kabayeva, the Duma promptly dusted off legislation that toughened the country's libel laws, equating the dissemination of deliberately false information damaging individual honor and dignity with the crimes of promoting terrorism or ethnic strife. The legislation not only prescribed civil penalties for the victims of libel, but allowed the government to shutter offending news organizations. A week after Putin denounced the article on the state of his marriage, the bill passed its first reading with 399 votes. Only one deputy dared to vote against it. By the time the legislation passed in its final form, though, Medvedev had already been elected president. In one of the first signs he might try to demonstrate a degree of independence and perhaps chart a new course, he vetoed it.